You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Disease Du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke to Dr. Courtney Mangano about New World Screwworm and the AAEP's new guidelines. This episode of Disease Du Jour is brought to you by Bimeda. Dr. Mangano works for the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets Division of Animal Industry, which is the state's veterinarian's office in New York. She graduated in 2002 from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She has been at the department for 20 years and manages many programs for the state, most notably overseeing all reportable equine diseases. She also oversees foreign animal disease investigations. She became a foreign animal disease diagnostician in 2015, which involves specialized training generally reserved for regulatory and military veterinarians to help investigate and manage confirmed or suspected outbreaks of highly contagious or exotic diseases in livestock and poultry. She has been an AAEP member for over 10 years and recently became a member of the Infectious Disease Committee. She is now part of the New World Screwworm Task Force that AAEP recently created and is a co-author on the AAEP's New World Screwworm Guidelines. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Mangano.
Hey, thank you.
I'm really excited to talk about this. It's obviously a very topical subject at the moment. To get us started, can you just give us a little bit of a current status of the outbreak? Where do we have confirmed cases at the moment, and what do we currently know or not know about how it might spread in the future?
Sure. Currently, there are 11 confirmed domestic cases in Texas and one in New Mexico. The confirmed cases in Texas have been detected in cattle and small ruminants. The confirmed case in New Mexico has been in a dog. Anyone can go online and look at the most current outbreak totals by looking at the USDA screwworm dashboard, which is on the screwworm.gov website. The dashboard also tracks wildlife and feral animals for those interested in that, as well as detections of the fly that is caught in fly traps. Each of those affected states also has their own website with helpful information. Unfortunately, we don't know where it is going next, but this is the work of the modelers at USDA to help us know where we may see the next detections.
For any veterinarian who is not really in this realm of medicine, can you give us just a brief overview of the New World screwworm organism itself, including its lifestyle and how it infects horses and other animals?
Sure. The New World screwworm infestation is caused by Cochleomyia hominivorax, a blowfly not native to the United States. For those interested in origins of why the fly is named that, I remember in vet school, some of our teachers wanted to give us name origins, and possibly to help you remember this, hominivorax equates to man consuming, and cochleomyia breaks down to cochleos, which means snail with a spiral shell, which refers to the screw-like spiral ridges seen on the larvae. And Maya means fly. This is a non-native parasitic blowfly whose larvae consume only living flesh of warm-blooded animals, making it unique from other native blowflies that we have here in the United States. Females breed once in their lifetime, but they can lay hundreds of eggs at a time at the edge of a wound. And they can lay these eggs more than once. The eggs hatch into larvae within 12 hours. The larvae begin feeding on living tissue at the edge of a wound or near a mucous membrane, which sometimes gets lost in the information that's handed out. As they feed, they burrow down into the skin, making wounds look deeper and larger. The larval feeding creates secretions and little oozes and a scent that attracts more flies. larvae become visible to our naked eye within 3 days. After a week, the larvae fall out of the wound or off of the animal. The larvae burrow into the ground to pupate. And depending on the climate, they emerge as flies from the soil in 7 to 65 days. Shorter time frame for warmer conditions and more preferred climate, 65 days, less and less preferred environmental conditions for the fly. The flies breed and the cycle starts over again. Other meiosis cases can look similar at a distance, which is why this warrants a more thorough exam. Non-New World screwworm meiosis lesions are more superficial. They occur on dead and dying tissue, and maggots can be seen in the matted hair or feces or other discharge. But New World screwworm lesions are going to be in living tissues, which continue to get larger and deeper over time. If that is the type of info that you could possibly gather from the owner, that they say, hey, this lesion is getting bigger or it's getting deeper throughout the course of a few days. The lesions are also going to be oozing and bleeding because that's what living tissue does. It oozes and bleeds. Maggots are going to be deeper within the wound, and you may even see egg packets present on the edges of the wound.
Yeah, that's quite unpleasant.
Yes. But helpful to know, sadly. Yeah.
What are some risk factors that would make a horse more susceptible to infection with New World screwworm?
Again, this is going to sound like a broken record, but animals with a wound from an injury or from a surgical or medical procedure or certain husbandry practices are our primary risk factor, making them more susceptible. Keep in mind, horses that are living in high-risk areas that are undergoing elective husbandry practices where wounds can be created, like clipping, branding, gelding, possibly dental procedures. We need to be sure to monitor these horses carefully and check those wounds and practice excellent wound care management. Also, those horses who are not halter broke or not easily handleable or are feral could have New World screwworm, but due to the lack of close examination on a regular basis, they can succumb to severe infestation. This doesn't make them more susceptible necessarily, but it's just another group to keep in mind if they are your patients.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think you mentioned before that mucous membranes can also be infested. Does that mean that horses, even if they don't have a wound, could potentially be at risk?
Yes, but again, we really need to think about, they're really attracted more to the wound.
Okay. This podcast is brought to you by Bimeda, the manufacturer of GastroBim. GastroBim, omeprazole, is the first and only FDA-approved bioequivalent to GastroGuard. Give your horse a scientifically proven, apple-flavored solution for gastric ulcers. Because equine gastric ulcer syndrome is complex, always work with your veterinarian for proper diagnosis and care. Same trusted treatment, less cost. That's GastroBim. The safety of GastroBim paste has not been determined in pregnant or lactating mares. For use in horses and foals 4 weeks of age and older. I think we went over clinical signs pretty thoroughly before, but are there any other signs that you want to point out that veterinarians should be watching out for in their patients?
I think what's important to say here is that wounds can be as small as a tick bite, but obviously can be much larger. We want to also look for changes in behavior in that animal. Is it acting differently than it usually does? Is it now more aggressive? Is it more quiet than normal? Is it isolating itself? Is it head shaking, stomping? Is it trying to like look at or get at the area where the wound or infestation is? Has it stopped eating? We want you to look everywhere. Take off the fly mask. Take off tack where a rub could be, which is a great area where you wouldn't be thinking about it, but that's where if you're creating a superficial wound, a fly could be getting there and creating a lesion. But as I mentioned, because it can also set up infestation around the mucous membranes. Look in the mouth. Some of those horses have that kind of like droopy lower lip. Look in the mouth, in the nares, in the ears. Lift up the tail. Check in the sheath, which is a common spot for that. We don't like doing that, but we need to check there. Check between the udders. In the umbilicus of foals, another common spot. Feel along the midline. Leave no stone unturned.
And then as far as differential diagnoses go, are there any like concrete features that you're going to be looking for that would help distinguish this infestation from those differentials while you're waiting for test results to come back and confirm your diagnosis?
This is a little bit more limited than some of our other talks that you've had with respiratory or diarrheal cases. You know, wounds with secondary bacterial infections, myiasis, that you can get from other non-New World screwworm flies. Both of these are going to involve getting a good history from the owner. You're going to have to look at that wound closely. Unless we're a trained parasitologist, we're not going to be able to tell a maggot from another type of maggot. And they don't want us to make that determination as regular veterinarians. They want us to be submitting these cases now that we have it in the country. So that is the important thing to note here. We have other differentials like pithiosis or abscesses. You're probably not going to be seeing maggots there. Those would be your other differentials. So the important thing is, if you see something, you need to be reporting it and not trying to make the differential, it's not New World screwworm. You better call.
Right. Yeah, great point. So how is New World screwworm transmitted, and how concerned should veterinarians in lower risk areas be right now, especially as horses begin to travel during the summer months and during horse shows? You know, is there like a meaningful risk of spread to some of these non-endemic regions?
All right. As I mentioned before, this is going to sound like a broken record. It's primarily transmitted through a wound, but you're going to need a competent New World screwworm fly in your area and animals with wounds. Vets in low-risk states like myself up here in the Northeast, we need to be aware of the disease and that it could spread if there's illegal movement of infested domestic animals or movement of infested wildlife, which introduces it to a new area. Some of these infested but untreated animals that have wounds could be in the early larval stages of development that we can't yet see with the naked eye. So it's important for animals that are coming out of these regions to be checked closely. Even if they're permitted to move, let's take a look at them. So if we know we're getting animals that are coming in from regions where there has been activity, let's take a look, make sure that they look okay. Not every wound is going to be doesn't mean that every wound is going to be, it's going to be screwworm, but let's just make sure that trailer ride and the bumps and bruises that they get, that everything looks okay. It's important to also follow any movement regulations and treatment recommendations that are put in place.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially about the wildlife, which is a little bit more of an uncontrolled variable in this outbreak.
Absolutely.
If a veterinarian suspects that their patient might have a New World screwworm infestation, what should their immediate next steps be in terms of who they should contact, what samples they should collect, and what they should do for that patient and other horses at the property while they're waiting for the diagnosis to come back?
Ideally, they need to isolate that animal as best as possible away from others. And I've also seen where they would like you to try to isolate it on a surface where the pupa can't bury into the ground. So if you can get them on a concrete surface or in a stall where they can't bury into the dirt, that would be ideal, if possible. Contact your regulatory officials in the state where you are. If you're advised by regulatory officials, administer a topical larvicide to kill off any of the superficial larvae that you may be seeing. You want to collect multiple larvae from in and around the wound because you could have different types of larvae. Some could be non-world screwworm, some could be secondary. After removing all the ones you need for sampling, then you go ahead and clean the wound free of the larvae. But you need to properly dispose of them in a secure manner. We can advise you as regulatory officials on how to do that. because the goal is that we don't want you to just throw them away in a manner where they can escape and pupate and make additional flies. So after you've removed them, you want to carefully clean the wound and keep it covered just as you normally do. You want to implement good wound management. Treat the animal with an approved product. Those list of those products changes often, but yet it can be found on the FDA website.
And the AAP's new World Screwworm guidelines also have recommendations for sampling as well. So we will leave those linked in the show notes, but I don't know if there's anything else in that document related to sampling that you want to call out.
I don't. It's pretty straightforward. You just need to put on a pair of gloves and make sure that you are not potentially having any of your own. If you have cuts or wounds on yourself, you want to make sure that you're covered and you want to be able to safely grab some of those larvae or maggots yourself and put them in the alcohol. You don't want to be using formalin. If you were to find a fly, which I have heard is not common, they would go in a separate dry container alone. You only have to complete one lab form. You may be advised, can you fill that out depending on what state you're in, or you may have someone that helps you at the state or federal level. And those samples are going to be shipped either to NBSL or another approved lab for confirmatory identification. It is important, though, that, again, like I just mentioned, you properly dispose of any larvae. If you see any pupae, that would be kind of, they're going to look brown. They're going to be kind of buried into the ground. Contaminated feed, bedding, or other contaminants, those need to be properly disposed of. That's very important. So if these animals come into your hospital, you need to, again, take care of that environment, the stall or the stocks or wherever that horse came into your environment. You need to properly dispose of that. If you're out at someone's stable or ranch, you also need to try to clean up as much of any of the larvae or any equipment with that. There is an SOP for that, and it's on the USDA website.
Okay. And also a great point about safety for the veterinarian as well, because New World screwworm, of course, can infest humans. So are there any other safety protocols that vets should be following?
No, just at a minimum, wearing gloves, especially when you're handling open wounds and dealing with a larvae. If they have any other concerns for their well-being, they probably want to discuss that with their physician. But for the most part, just general, mostly for your hands, covering up your hands or any other open wounds. Because you may not know that you may have gotten a fly bite necessarily, or you don't know what bit you, but you know, you kind of brush it off and you're carrying on with your work. So again, if you're out in a high-risk area, best to keep those covered right now.
Yep. Yeah, makes sense.
Yep.
What are the current treatment recommendations for horses with the confirmed infestation?
This information, I don't want to quote certain products because as soon as we do and someone hears this months later, it would probably be outdated. It is located on the FDA website. As you mentioned, AAEP has also created a terrific guidelines for prevention and treatment. This is an evolving situation. So we're going to hopefully see more products get added to the website. They come on periodically. So if you are involved as a veterinarian with these situations and you are finding yourself that you need to check for treatment or prevention, please check that website frequently as products do come on. I will note, though, that fewer treatment options exist specifically for horses. And those products that are approved, they're also approved for other species as well, which can create a high demand for these treatments. So plan ahead, kind of look ahead. If you're in a high-risk area and you think I may be treating them, you may want to have some of those in stock because these things may go out of stock or whatever. I'm just thinking ahead. I like to plan ahead and don't want you to try to go and order it and find that everyone else is needing that too.
Yeah, that's a great point. You don't want to have an affected patient and not be able to get treatment for it.
Yeah. Yes.
What is the typical prognosis for horses that have New World screwworm? And what are some factors that tend to influence the outcomes?
The prognosis is going to vary depending on the extent and the location of the wound. but also the ability to treat the animal. A small wound on a horse that you handle every day, who's easy to work with, has a much, much better prognosis than that wild child horse that you can't get near, or a horse that has really significant lesions because it's a very advanced case, or you didn't know about it for quite a while. And infested animals that aren't treated in 7 to 14 days could die. So there's quite a variable range there, but I believe that a lot of the horses that we tend to interact with are looked at a lot and handled a lot. So hopefully this is a better outlook for our horse population than some of the other species that may be susceptible to New World screwworm.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully owners are also taking a lot more precautions right now and observing their horses, checking their wounds regularly.
Yeah. And also looking in areas that maybe otherwise they wouldn't, because, you know, we kind of look in our normal spots and go, they look good today. You know, we do our temp and we, you know, we kind of check our feet and things like that. But this is the time, especially if you're in a high risk area or you've recently traveled and you've got wounds, let's do a little bit more thorough looking and having our horses getting used to us looking in a lot more areas.
Yes. What are some biosecurity precautions that veterinarians in at-risk regions should be taking routinely right now? And what additional protocols should they implement if they have suspected or confirmed cases?
You know, in general, we always need to be practicing good wound care and wound management. That is an all the time, really shouldn't matter where you are. Following all required treatment protocols. Again, I'm going back to thinking about look ahead to what is available treatment-wise for horses. Plan ahead. Think about what can I use? Should I get a case? So have that ready, but also follow those treatment protocols if you get a case. Don't skip out and cut corners on that. Let's get this treated and get your case done. Do not contaminate the environment further. That's a good biosecurity measure. So I mentioned, make sure that if you treat a suspect or a known case, don't just treat the wound and then pack up and leave. Let's make sure we try to pick up as much potential larvae, pupae in the ground, contaminated bedding, all that kind of stuff. We don't want anything becoming more flies, which puts it into the environment and creating more potential cases. So that's a good biosecurity point of view for those in an at-risk area. And then let's monitor other animals that could be in close proximity to affected ones or suspect ones and report any cases. You want to convey that to the owners. I think they're getting that messaging anyway if they are on an affected premises from regulatory officials, but if you're not in a known affected area, but you may suddenly become in one, this is new to you to start thinking about that. You want to start monitoring animals in close proximity to one. So you may be in a neighboring county where there's some activity nearby. Let's start monitoring those. And let's talk with our clients and say, hey, if you start seeing anything, please let me know. Don't wait on this. This is so important because this can take a while to get ahead of.
Yeah, definitely. Great point. Before we wrap up today, are there any misconceptions about New World screwworm that you would like to address or any other important considerations for veterinarians that you want to call out?
I have one of each. The one misconception that I would like to address is really not something that I have seen from our colleagues, but I've seen it a fair bit from their clients on social media. When this kind of first erupted, you know, a week or two ago, there was a lot of chatter online that this is just fly strike. And we've had this in the country for a long time. This is not regular fly strike. And that's going to be a problem. And the animals are going to pay a consequence if owners continue to think that this is regular fly strike. So I think as veterinarians, we need to tell them that while it can be similar to something that maybe that owner has had to deal with on their property before, there is a difference and they need to contact their vet. And so we need to kind of have that conversation with them. So that was a little bit alarming. I do see some people that are trying to right that ship a little bit on social media, but there's people that are adamant it's still regular fly strike and it's not. And I don't want animals to suffer the consequences of that misconception. A parting comment for my colleagues is that reporting suspect cases and identifying infested areas is the only way to allow eradication efforts by the sterile insect technique to really take a good foothold. Is what we call it, works, but it takes several rounds to be effective. Failure to identify these cases allows for the proliferation and spread to new areas, which is exactly what we don't need. Monitoring animals before and after movement to shows or training or any other type of events from infested zones is crucial. So if clients are receiving animals from infested zones post-treatment, be sure to have them monitored closely upon arrival. Did you want me to talk about sterile insect technique real quick? So folks, if they've seen it, aren't sure what that is?
Yeah, let's go over that quickly. I think it's a really amazing way that we've been able to address this in the past. So,
okay, it's just a real quick summary in case people have seen it. So sterile insect technique is often referred to as SIT and has been used since the 50s. It has helped eradicate New World screwworm that was here in the United States back in the 60s. It's helped eradicate it from Mexico and Central America in the second half of the 20th century. It uses gamma radiation to irradiate male pupae, which eventually create sterile male flies. This procedure, it doesn't affect the wild females out in the wild and breed with them. It doesn't affect that. It doesn't affect their life cycle. The sterile males are mass produced. And when I say mass, like millions and millions and millions, they are produced in these factories. And then they are strategically released in regions to help find and mate with wild females. The goal is that they mate with the wild females, and those females will then lay unfertilized eggs. So gradually over time, the population declines. That's the best way to do this. So it's going to take several times to reduce the population. This is not a quick, you know, you don't just dump these out one time and say, okay, well, then we should be good. It takes a bit of time for the release of either sterile male pupae or flies to start to gradually reduce the population. So people need to be patient, but it does work.
Yeah, really impressive. And the male flies themselves don't actually pose any risk to mammals, correct?
Correct. And they're not genetically modified. They've just been irradiated so that they're sterile. So that helps break that life cycle, which is what we need, because we can't control an insect that's flying above us. Additionally, this also helps prevent, for those that are really concerned about the environment, this is not releasing pesticides. And that's a big deal, because how do you control things where you've got wildlife running around? You don't really know where it's going to pop up next. So the concept of the male's going to know how to find a female fly, that's beyond our human understanding, but they'll go out and disperse them where they think they're going to be. And it's a wonderful concept and technique, and let the insects do what they do. But again, we need to reiterate, it's going to take time. Once you do the release, it takes several of these to actually start to make a dent, but they will get eliminated and we will go back to having a much easier life.
Yes. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the podcast and explaining this outbreak with a little bit more detail for us. I'm sure this is something that's on everyone's mind at the moment, so I really appreciate having your insight.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for the invite.
I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Mangano for joining us, and thank you to Bimita for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.